The official job description of our guest on The Year That Made Me today is not censorship commissar, but that is what the world's richest man, Elon Musk, called her. Julie Inman-Grant has been Australia's eSafety Commissioner since 2017. Her second term in that role ends in January of 2027. As eSafety Commissioner, Julie's been a prominent national and increasingly global advocate for measures intended to make citizens safer online. That included trying to get social media companies to remove the footage of the stabbing of Bishop Murray Emanuel during a church service in 2024, the move that earned Elon Musk's ire. Julie Inman-Grant, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thank you. You would think that that was The Year That Made Me. That was almost The Year That Undid Me.
Sure, it sounds like a tough one. Now, Julie, I'm trying to work out from your accent, which part of Australia were you born in?
I was born in the northwest corner of the United States. I've been here for 25 years, but I think the accent was fairly deeply embedded, and I can't even get my palate to say anything properly Australian. Although when I do go back home, people say things like, why are you up talking? And what's a dog's breakfast? So after a while, you start to forget what is a colorful Australian colloquialism. And, you know, it's become part of my linguistic furniture, I guess you'd say.
So you grew up outside Seattle in a single parent household. What was life like for you, your mum, Glenda, and your sister, Amy?
Oh my goodness, you've been doing some background research. We also had a dog, Maya. So I grew up in a very female-dominated household. And my mom did struggle. We were the kids that wore the hand-me-down clothes because my mother loved to travel. So the minute wall came down in China, she was out there. You know, she had endless curiosity there. She was a great role model, and I had a great role model in my stepmother, Mary Pat. I can tell you both of their stories. But I think one of the things as a latchkey kid, I had to become pretty self-sufficient early on. My mom started going back to work when I was 5 years old. Sometimes I had a babysitter. Sometimes I had to fend for myself. But one thing I did learn as I watched her struggle is that, you know, I think that made me very focused on being independent and economically self-sufficient, not really wanting to have anyone else to depend on to make my way in the world.
Your mum worked at the city of Seattle and had a notorious work colleague. I'm not sure how closely they worked together, but what did you hear about your mum's time at work at the city of Seattle?
Well, my mother worked at the Board of Ethics and Fair Campaign Practices for more than 20 years, but up in the city attorney's office was a very striking and charming young lawyer named Ted Bundy. Wow. And friends of the family who were journalists, his name was Richard Larson, wrote a book about Bundy and literally believed he was innocent until those final days on death row where he actually did admit his guilt. But that led my mother to always say, you know, Julie, make sure you look into, men's eyes. The eyes are the window to the soul. And while he was charming, he had cold, dead eyes. I don't know that she would have said that had he not come out as one of the world's most notorious serial killers. But there you go.
Yeah, but by that point, it seems like a fair comment to say the least. Julie, you mentioned your stepmother as well. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the work that she did and also the role of your father in terms of your developing sense of social justice.
My father and my biological mother, Glenda, met each other in Washington state politics. So I've always kind of had an interest in politics, policy, and government service. So my father was recruited into the Korean War, came back, and his father was a lawyer, his brother was a lawyer, and what else was he going to do but go to law school, which he did, and then he ended up as a competition lawyer for Burlington Northern, the railroad. So when I was representing Microsoft in Washington, D.C., and the whole antitrust thing was happening, it was a little bit of history repeating itself. But he also became a bit of an activist for gun control back in the 90s. My stepmother, Mary Pat Laffey Inman, started flying for Northwest Airlines in 1958 when women could refer to as stewardesses and men were pursers. And women had height and weight requirements, could only fly until they were 32 and couldn't be married, get pregnant, et cetera, and had to share rooms. So in 1965, the Civil Rights Act passed in the United States. And while it was really meant to be about racial discrimination, what a lot of people don't know is a congressman from Virginia slipped in a provision around gender with the aim of killing the bill, but it went through anyway. So Mary Pat applied to become the airline's first female purser. And at first they rejected that and said, you have to take a test, and they changed it and she blew it out of the water. So long story short is she fought Northwest Airlines for 14 years in a very significant class, sexual discrimination class action suit. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court a couple of times, but she ended up winning on behalf of 32,000 flight attendants, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the final opinion. So it was quite a significant piece. And there's a documentary streaming on SBS called Come Fly With Me that kind of chronicles a lot of the flight attendants' struggles for, and pilots' struggle for equality in those early days.
Well, given all those experiences amongst your family, it's perhaps not surprising that you ended up working in the area that you did. But let's work our way towards that now, Julie. I've got to say that saying you turned down a job as a CIA agent is a very sneaky cover story for a CIA agent. Could you give us the full cover story, though?
The full cover story was I finished Boston University, a degree in international relations, and I wanted to come to DC. You know, I had big ideals and even bigger hair, as it was the early 1990s. But we were in recession. And so I had really three job opportunities. One was to work for my hometown congressman in Congress. The second was at the Department of Commerce. And the third was at the CIA, and again, back to Ted Bundy, not to, you know, go back to serial killers, but I was very interested in doing psychological profiling. And so I got a interview, and they tried to talk me into becoming a case agent. And, you know, I did a 40-page application with every bad thing I'd ever done in my life and had to take a lie detector test. And then they started telling me what it really meant in terms of not being able to tell my family and friends what I was doing and deceiving people. And I just thought, this is not for me. I much prefer to be a little bit more of an open book.
We're speaking with Australia's eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, on The Year That Made Me. And so, Julie, the decision not to go into the CIA meant that I think you went for one of the other options you just mentioned, working for a congressman, Republican Congressman John Miller. What was that like?
Well, it was a very different time. That was when they had what we would call Rockefeller Republicans. So he was very progressive. We worked across the aisle. He was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. This was 1991 and 92, and I was working on a range of social issues, and he popped his head over the cubicle one day and said, hey, the telecommunications infrastructure is being deregulated. Do you want to work on telco issues? And maybe technology, too. We've got this small little company in our electorate called Microsoft. So that's when I really started working at the intersection of social justice, technology, and policy before there was an internet back in 1991. But I also had the opportunity to do some really interesting work around international education. And so I developed, when I was 22, something called the Foreign Language Economic Enhancement Act, which sought to sort of bring foreign language competency and align it with both defense, national security defense, and but also economic competitiveness issues, which really aligned with his foreign affairs position, but my interest in language and culture.
You did that for a couple of years, 1991 and 1992. And I think that gets us, Julie, into the territory of the year that you've chosen as the year that made you. What have you chosen and why?
Well, I did have 2 years where I was working at a not-for-profit and then going to graduate school at night, again, studying international communications, which is looked at international, intercultural communication, but also the impact of technology on society between 93 and 95. And to get my final master's degree, I had to have relative fluency in a language, and I had studied Italian for 4 years in uni. So I finished off my degree, moved to Florence to do some deep immersion. I fell in love with a Dutchman who wore white socks, black shoes, and jeans, very much like Seinfeld. So, following a few months of living and working in Italy, I made my way up to the Netherlands, and then I landed a job in Brussels working on a green paper on intellectual property rights, and so really starting to again use those skills of working in a policy environment that looked at tech policy and how that was evolving. But I sort of thought, oh, I really got to get back to the real world and my life back in the U.S. So I flew back to D.C. and was going to get my hatchback and just drive back home to Seattle. And I was couch surfing. And I was actually on my ex-boyfriend's couch. And he said, I can't believe this. You just got a call like from a recruiter at Microsoft who wants to talk to you about a job in DC. I was like, what? I've never applied to Microsoft. And, you know, this was to be the second person in their Washington, DC government affairs office. So that was really a very obviously a pivotal moment being in tech policy ground zero. And so in 1995 was when Congress started deliberating the Communications Decency Act. And the big end of town in terms of technology, what was Microsoft, AOL, AltaVista, CompuServe, Prodigy, Netscape, and Novell, many companies that aren't around anymore. There were hundreds of bills at the state level and at the federal level that were focused on taxing e-commerce and the internet. And, you know, as a small cohort of companies, and then there was a group that's still around today called the Center for Democracy and Technology, there was real concern that overregulation of the internet at this early stage would really, you know, restrict its growth and its full potential. And so this is where Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act came in, and it was very much shaped by those of us in industry, but we never saw social media coming. That was almost 10 years down the track, and this provided platforms with intermediary immunity from liability from user-generated content effectively. Never thought that this would be sustained for more than 30 years.
From studying Italian in Florence to lobbying in Washington, 1995 was obviously a massive year. Julie, did you ever find out why or how it was that Microsoft came to approach you?
Apparently, I had been smart enough to send my CV out to a number of people before I went to Europe, and someone held on to it and handed it to a recruiter, thought I had the right background and experience. And either I did, or I just sort of slipped under their proper surveillance for good talent. I'm not sure.
And Julie, you've described your time working in the commercial side of the tech industry, mainly for Microsoft, but also for pre-Elon Twitter, as trying to change things from the inside. What did that time teach you about the potential and the prospects for changing things from the inside?
In the early to mid 2000s, being at Microsoft was a really exciting place to be because they did invest and care a lot about safety. You know, they invested in PhotoDNA, which was an invention by Professor Hani Farid and Microsoft Research. And that is still the technologies that's used to detect most known child sexual abuse material, and also used around detecting terrorist content. They created a digital crimes unit, invested a lot in training law enforcement officials and working more closely with them. So that was a really important heady time. I did work around security, privacy, and safety across Asia Pacific for 5 years. And then I had 3 years as their global head of privacy and safety. So doing lots of product reviews, writing the company's first trust and safety policy, and putting together the first, cross-functional cabinet around online safety. So a lot of these big companies that you see today, from Google to Meta and Microsoft, they've acquired a range of companies and products over time, and often their systems don't speak together or different product areas take different approaches to safety. And so this was an effort to really try and get the right hand speaking to the left hand. And I'll never forget sort of bringing the whole idea of safety by design to my leadership, saying, hey, we're looking for security vulnerabilities and privacy breaches. What about consumer safety? Even though at that time, Xbox was pretty toxic, and we just acquired Nokia as well as Skype, and it was a live vector for live stream child sexual abuse material then. And I just kind of got the eye roll, you know, Julie, we're becoming a cloud and enterprise company, and, you know, we're not going to focus on consumer safety anymore. And so I think that was a very large clue to me that I'd probably done as much as I could to try and move mountains and be that antagonist inside. But, you know, the engineers and the revenue and product people were always going to have more power.
Julie Inman Grant, what brought you to Australia? And more importantly, what made you stay?
Well, after 5 years in Washington, D.C. for a total of 9 years, and it was a pretty intense 5 years. You can imagine, you know, in the midst of the antitrust trial, you know, I would go to social things, and D.C. is very much about who you know rather than who you are anyway. And you can't even go to any kind of social event without people asking you what you do or who you work for. And I knew every time I opened my mouth and said I worked for Microsoft, I'd get the, oh, the evil empire, blah, 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 blah. It was, you know, it really took a toll. And, you know, I was 32 and I was single. And we like to say at that time, because the proportion of men to women was 70% men to 30% women, was the odds were good, but the goods were odd. So I just said, please send me away somewhere. I'd love an international experience. And they sent me as far away as they could to a former penal colony. Anyway, that's how I landed in Australia. My parents had spent their cold, gray, wet USA winters in Manly. So I knew that I would have them 3 months out of the year. And so it was for a 2-year stint to sort of set up Microsoft's philanthropy, government relations, and industry affairs program. And about 4 or 5 months in, I met my future husband, a dashing young man from Melbourne who was staying at my neighbor's house, locked himself out on Boxing Day and had to break a window to get back into the house. So he basically was a meet cute, looked over the balcony to tell me that he wasn't breaking in, but that he did indeed know my neighbors. So that's how we met. And that was, 25 years ago.
You've been in the job of a safety commissioner for the best part of a decade. How different is that job now compared to when Malcolm Turnbull appointed you back in 2017?
It's almost grown tenfold. We started with a 10 million annual budget to about 55 million, which is still small by government standards. I mean, you might describe eSafety's regulatory functions as growing organically, or you could describe us as a little bit of a Frankenstein. So we started as Australia's hotline, taking reports of child sexual abuse material. We created the first and still only youth-based cyberbullying scheme. And then we moved on to the image-based abuse scheme, which was originally named the revenge porn scheme. But I said, I'm not going to call it revenge porn. Revenge for what? That's sort of victim blaming. After the Christchurch atrocity, we were given powers around abhorrent violent conduct. and additional powers around terrorist and violent extremist content. And then, of course, we moved on to serious adult cyber abuse. I often talk about protection, and that's through the complaint schemes and the systemic powers, prevention through education, research, and awareness. But then the third P that was kind of missing from the OSA and the regulatory construct was that piece around proactive and systemic change. So how are we really going to limit the threat surface for the future? How are we going to develop that anticipatory mindset where we're looking at the future of technology so it doesn't hit us in the face, so we can anticipate it and be prepared? And then how do we put the onus and responsibility for safety back on the platforms themselves, like we do with every other consumer-facing industry? The analogy that seems to work for people is, you know, the whole idea of parliaments forcing car manufacturers back in the 70s to embed seatbelts. We talk a lot about today about technological exceptionalism. And, you know, I believe we should be having these companies build their products to Australian safety standards, and they should be embedding those virtual seatbelts and erecting those digital guardrails. They understand the harms and the risks, and they should be embedding those safety protections at the front end rather than retrofitting after the damage has been done. And this is safety by design, and safety by design is a precursor for the whole policy idea of duty of care.
There's no doubt that over the decade you've been in the role, the number of issues, the complexity of them, and just the sheer scale of them has heaped up massively. That, I suppose, has meant that as well as looking at harms done to other people, you've been subjected to a lot of really terrible conduct because of the position that you hold and the stances that you take. You told Time magazine that you get credible death threats, that your kids have been doxxed. That is just horrible to contemplate. Is that the worst part of being the eSafety Commissioner?
Let me just start by saying it's an honor and a privilege to be in a role like this where you can really make, I think, important change. So I start from that perspective of just being grateful. You know, I think my adrenal glands are shot because you are running on adrenaline and doing this for 9 years. And it is like I work every weekend. I have to stay on top of things. And, you know, the irony is not lost on me that I've experienced what we call the 3Ds of acute cyber abuse. So, yeah, death threats, doxing, and deepfakes.
Julie, let me ask you the question that you asked your staff when you walked into the office of eSafety Commissioner. 10 years later, what do you think's working? What do you think isn't?
Well, I think we have to take a holistic approach to online safety. And I do think the protection, prevention, and proactive change underpinned by partnerships is the right approach. It's the approach that Australia has successfully taken to water safety. You know, not only do we put fences around pools, we back that with enforcement, but we teach our kids to swim, we supervise them, we have lifeguards, we teach them to swim between the flags in the ocean, we put up shark nets, we teach them about rips. We have to do all of that in the online safety context as well. You could say taking a public health approach to this, just like slip, slop, slap. These kinds of cultural reset campaigns, these normative changes like we're trying to achieve through the social media minimum age legislation, will take time to really bed down and become routinized into the fabric of what we do. And, you know, I believe in a few years, not only will kids say, oh, 16 is not only the year I learn how to drive, it's the year I can go on social media.
Julie Inman-Grand, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.